Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance, go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in the space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. This is Space Talk. I am Jim Behnke, and I hope you're going to stick around with us during the next hour or so as we have a lot of information to share about you, about what's going on with your space program. And we talk with Wayne Hale, a former NASA flight director who continues to participate and contribute to NASA, and who is absolutely among one of my most favorite people working for the space agency today. You are invited to join in the conversation by calling 768-1240 or *1240 if you are a local wireless customer of AT&T. And from the rest of the planet, you can dial 321-768-1240. To reach us, or simply email your questions and comments to spacetalking@aol.com. All of those methods will get you right into the WMMB studio right here on Florida's Space Coast. Well, today's space program, a Space Talk program, brought to you by our sponsor, United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Once again, United Space Alliance, the sponsor of Space Talk. Well, before we do get to Wayne in a little bit here, let's take a few moments and update you on some of the space-related activity that's been going on with the program here and around the nation and around the world, in fact, with the news this week. First of all, big congratulations locally here to Frank DiBello, now the permanent president of Space Florida. He'd been the interim president for several months now. And after some activity with the selection committee and board this week and the dust settled, Frank DiBello remains president of Space Florida, and I think you'll see now that he has the reins fully belonging to him now and not have that word interim in front of his title, you can see some smart and interesting things happening with Space Florida here now coming up very quickly. In fact, we hope to have Frank on the show here again within the next couple of weeks to update you on what's happening at Space Florida. Space Shuttle Discovery, still at Edwards Air Force Base in California. It landed there about a week ago, and it is now safely bolted atop its 747 carrier jet. However, it remains at Edwards today. They're continuing to be a sort of a day-for-day slip here in the journey home. The weather across the southern half of the United States has been just a little bit unsettled, as a lot of you know. And they need that weather to clear up to begin the trip. Right now, the best guess is that Discovery will begin that ferry flight tomorrow morning and fly probably, looks like, to Louisiana and spend the night there. And then again, if the weather cooperates and there are no other issues to be concerned with, should return to the Kennedy Space Center sometime about 10:30 on Monday morning. Now, we get very little advance warning of that when it happens. Generally, we will know a couple hours in advance that it's about to happen. But in terms of when Discovery will actually appear in our skies, it's kind of a sudden thing. Everyone stick close to their phones and their friends and their neighbors, watch the web, and just be watching for that news. If everything goes according to the way it normally does, Discovery and the 747 will approach basically from Orlando straight over to the Space Coast. Depending on where he, where the pilot enters, sort of the pattern here on the Space Coast, he'll make a right turn, fly south, basically to over the Pineda Causeway, do a big looping wide left turn, 180 degrees, just south of the Pineda Causeway, down by Patrick Air Force Base, and then begin a trip back to the Kennedy Space Center, about 1,000 feet high, officially, along the beach, heading north. And then he'll go in and land back at the Kennedy Space Center. So for about 15, 20 minutes there, some point Monday morning, when everyone suddenly stops driving in front of you and looking up, it's probably because they see the shuttle on the 747. And if you have never seen this sight, you don't have many opportunities left. There's only 6 shuttle missions to go. And if they should all land at the Kennedy Space Center, which is certainly the hope, this could be the last time you ever have a chance to see a shuttle on top of a 747 like this. And, again, it is an amazing sight to behold. It's one of the coolest things related to the shuttle program, I think. Let's see what else is going on. At the International Space Station this week, our own Kennedy Space Center former employee Nicole Stott, now no longer a rookie astronaut, a veteran astronaut on board the space station, used the space station's robot arm and plucked the Japanese H-2 transfer vehicle from orbit and snuggled up right up against one of the nodes there. And this new cargo vehicle that's provided by Japan, the Japanese Space Agency, again, another way to get cargo up to the International Space Station. And that whole procedure went very well. This was the first time that had ever been done at the station. Of course, the shuttle has used its robot arm and picked things out of space many times before, but the station, a much larger object, much more refined maneuvers that have to take place to get everything in just the right spot for Nicole to reach out there with the Canadian arm, the Canadian station arm, and take care of that vehicle and bring it in. So that whole thing worked out great. This is what we're going to see a lot in the future. And big kudos to her and to the entire crew and team for making that happen. In fact, big congratulations to Japan just for getting that thing up there and getting ready to go, and it all went so well. So this is another great new capability for all of us to be able to work and live in space. We talked about six more shuttle missions coming up. The NASA, I think it was yesterday, named what could be the final space shuttle crew. We now know all the astronauts that are going to fly for the remaining flights, and Steve Lindsay, veteran astronaut, currently the chief astronaut, will command the last mission, Discovery, STS-133, now targeted for launch in September of 2010. That should be the last flight. It's an all-veteran crew that will include Nicole Stott, who's up in the space station now, Michael Barrett, who's also up on the station now. It's an all-veteran crew, again, going up for the last flight. We got a Delta II launch kind of on the books here, possibly this week. It was supposed to go this weekend some point. There's some last-minute reviews of the spacecraft that's taking place. And right now, United Launch Alliance and NASA is saying no earlier than Wednesday, the launch between 8 a.m. and 9 a.m. Eastern time. This is a NASA-managed launch for the Missile Defense Agency. The satellite's called a Space Tracking and Surveillance System Demonstration spacecraft, a test spacecraft for the Missile and Defense Agency. And again, no word on exactly when it's going to fly. It's not that it's a secret launch. It's just that they did have some issues with the spacecraft they wanted to review. Not a lot of detail beyond that, but it is taking them some extra time to do all those reviews. And so right now, that Delta II launch no earlier than Wednesday. And again, we'll keep an eye out on you for that. Thursday, the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan was busy. I'm telling you, there's a lot going on in space and on the ground. A weather satellite was launched in a Soyuz rocket. 3 hours later, a Proton rocket launched from the same space center with a Canadian commercial satellite that'll be used for the Dish Network company up in Canada. Way up on Mars, some news going on. The Spirit rover remains stuck on Mars, and the words from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory this week was a little bit of pessimism that it looks like Spirit may be stuck in this sandbar for good. They're going to make another run at getting it freed sometime in October, but again, they're beginning to preach pessimism instead of optimism. And it may be that Spirit will remain where it is. It's still active. It's still working. It's still doing its science. It just can't rove. And is that too bad? Well, absolutely. But consider this. When it arrived in January of 2004, this thing was designed. The thing was designed to only last 90 days and move about 900 feet. And that's it. But it's lasted so far 5 years and traveled 4.8 miles. So I think we got our money's worth out of Spirit and Opportunity on the other side of the planet working just fine. So that's a little bit of what's going on this week in space. When we return after this upcoming break here, we're going to have a conversation with NASA's Wayne Hale that I guarantee you will not want to miss. In the meantime, let me remind you that you can listen to Space Talk on the web right now, streaming live at WMMBAM.com. We're streaming the program live, and early next week, you'll be able to download a podcast of today's program. And if you want to hear yourself on the show today, give us a call right now, 321-768-1240 with your questions and comments. We're going to have Wayne Hale on in just a moment. But for now, this is Space Talk on WMMB, brought to you by United Space Alliance.
Now, back to our own mission specialist, Jim Behnke.
welcome back to Space Talk. Let's get right to our guest from NASA. At least let me begin to introduce him. And he's going to have to be patient because I'm going to say some nice things about him. But first, I want you to know I've been looking forward to this interview as much as I did the Vikings beating the Browns last weekend. And I hope everyone listening is going to take advantage of this man's opportunity to talk to him today by giving us a call here at 321-768-1240 or emailing your comments or questions to spacetalking@AOL.com. And we already have one question by email today. So thank you very much. Wayne Hale is my special guest today. He joined NASA in 1978 as a propulsion officer at the Johnson Space Center, worked his way up through the ranks, became a flight director in 1988, and then spent the next few years helping direct 41 shuttle missions, quite often as the launch or entry flight director. He made the inevitable move up into management. I don't know whether he really liked that or not, but anyway, he made it up there and became a key figure in the return to flight efforts following the 2000 Columbia tragedy, spending some time as Space Shuttle Program Manager. And last year was assigned to his current post of Deputy Associate Administrator of Strategic Partnerships, and we'll ask him what that means. Those are the basic facts, but let me introduce Wayne by saying this. Now, I have never met or gotten to know a flight director that I didn't have respect for. These are special people who are responsible for the safety and success of the mission. And I have to tell you, and I think a lot of my longtime friends in the media would agree, that when we heard that when Wayne Hale was on console, you could watch the activity in Mission Control with a greater sense of security, a greater sense of confidence that the right decisions would be made, that everything would be right with the world at the end of the day. I truly believe he is among NASA's best, a modern-day Christopher Kraft or Gene Kranz, and I'm proud to welcome him to our program today. Wayne, it's good to have you with us.
Well, it's good to be with you, Jim. What an introduction. What can I say after that?
Well, you certainly deserve it, sir. And let's talk for a few minutes about your experience as a flight director. Now, I know astronauts always get the question, what's it like in space? And some of them cringe at that question, and some of them answer it quite nicely. Let's try it out for size with you. But let's ask you, what's it like to be a flight director? You're standing there, it's a few minutes before launch, or it's a few minutes before you have to make the go, no-go for a deorbit burn to land a shuttle. What's that like to stand there and be responsible?
Well, it's a great feeling knowing you have a great team that you've been working together with for many months to prepare for those moments. Of course, there's a great deal of responsibility, and it weighs heavily on your mind, but we have practiced what we're doing, we have been through all the training, and after a few flights, the experience that's under your belt makes you feel confident that you can make the right decision and make sure that if it's safe to go, we'll execute, and if it's not, we'll wait till the next day. And either way, those are good decisions.
You ever feel yourself being one that either erred on the side of caution or maybe took a little risk now and then? Or I mean, how do you measure that?
Well, I think I even wrote about it in my blog one time about how rookie flight directors can kill you.
That's
and
right.
Looking back on my very first entry, I did send the crew to a place or a situation that maybe wasn't quite the safest. So you learn from those experiences and go forward.
Now, I remember early on in my career as a journalist, one of the things that I didn't understand, I didn't get, was this whole concept of flight control. I guess philosophy. You know, why do you make the decisions that you make, and what guides you to make those decisions? When I learned that flight rules were really more guidelines than anything else, I had a problem with the hard Webster definitions of all these words. And I remember talking to you. I remember talking to Gene Kranz and others about that. And one of the themes that came out that struck me and remains with me today is this notion of keeping your options open. Is that really what guides everything? At every point, you're trying to keep your options open so that you don't shut down one idea as you get to the next?
Well, you know, we are trying to accomplish a mission. So we have trained and planned for more than a year in advance for every shuttle mission. Everything we're going to do every day has been thought through, pitted against other options that we might do. And so we think we have the very best plan that we can put together. And we train that way, but when the day comes and you're faced with a specific situation, maybe something you'd thought of, maybe something nobody'd thought of, you really need to take as much time as is available to you to look at the options, look at the way forward, what is the best way to go. And you take the rules as a starting point, and in most cases, that's exactly what you're going to do. But in some cases, there will be some nuance or circumstance or particular thing that's going on that day that says maybe what the flight rule said is not the best way to proceed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the judgment and training and experience all comes to play.
And certainly that's where we as laymen have to trust you to make the right call. And I know that, you know, you work out these procedures, but the simulations seem to me, just, and you just mentioned, so important. You know, that you've tried to goof it up as many different ways as you can and still recover what's going on. That's got to give you a lot of different options to consider every time you see something go wrong.
We have a wonderful training team, and they love their jobs because they sit around and they think about all the things that could go wrong. It's like playing a chess game to see how the flight control team's going to react. Sometimes we react the way they expect. Sometimes we surprise them, but we always learn in those training sessions, and they're invaluable.
Now, is a flight director position, Wayne, more of a leadership position? Is it, I mean, you've got to have the technical background, but do you need to be a hardcore engineer to work into that position? Do you need to be a good leader, a good communicator? What are the skill sets?
We absolutely have to have the technical background. It is a technical field. You have to understand the engineering. You have to understand the orbital mechanics. You have to understand the medicine sometimes that we have to talk about with the crew.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a leadership position. You are with a group of folks who have been assigned to the team. You've got to mold them into a team and prove that they can do the job that's ahead of you. We have to mentor some of the new flight controllers as they go through their training to bring them to a certified status and get them out on console. And every day that you are working in the flight director's office, you are exercising your job as a leader. It's a great job in many ways, and not the least of which is you get to avoid some of the bureaucracy that much of the other parts of NASA management have to put up with,
right.
Unfortunately found out.
And as you recently wrote in one of your blogs, always make sure that you inform senior management with every decision you're going to make.
Absolutely. There is a myth that the flight director is there by himself making the decision. And, you know, if it's absolutely time critical in the middle of launch or something like that, yes, that's true, but 99% of the time you're talking about making a decision about how something will be done tomorrow or 6 hours from now, and you'd be foolish not to call in help and get other folks' perspective on how you should proceed.
Well, and let me ask you quick about the relationship between you as a flight director and the shuttle mission commander. I've heard it described at one point that the flight director is responsible for the success of the mission, and you share responsibility for the safety with the commander ultimately responsible for the safety. Is that a way to phrase it, or am I missing a nuance?
Well, you know, it's again, you're in a teamwork situation. The shuttle commander is on the scene. He's got information that you don't have as a flight director on the ground. The flight director on the ground has this huge team of people and all these resources and a lot of information the shuttle commander doesn't have at his fingertips. And so you've got to learn to work together. You've got to learn to trust each other. And through the years, I've had relationships with commanders that were just great, hand-in-glove kind of relationship,
mm-hmm.
And great camaraderie. And then we've had some prickly situations where you kind of had to bite your P's and Q's, and sometimes things didn't work as smoothly as you hoped they would.
And certainly that reflects the fact that we're all human and a little different, and so you're going to get a variety. Astronauts are not cookie-cutter people, let's put it that way.
They are not. You know, sometimes I think the public gets the impression that they're all alike, but no, they're human beings, and everyone's unique and an individual.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, let me ask you about culture, and we've got just a couple of minutes here before our next break, but following the Columbia disaster, Wayne, as you know, there was a lot of talk about the culture in NASA and how it needed to be changed to adopt a new way of looking at things. And you were right on the forefront of that. And in fact, I think you were very much known for embracing that concept and really did some unique things to try to change the culture. How do you assess where the culture is at today? And is it poised to move on to the future?
Well, you know, changing a culture in an organization is very difficult and it takes a long time. But after about 6 years, I think we've made great inroads, and many things are much better than they were before Columbia. You know, it's almost a generational thing. The way in which our parents' generation reacted to leadership and authority is different than the way the younger generation today reacts to leadership and authority.
Mm-hmm.
And what came out of, you know, maybe the World War II kind of generation of just take orders doesn't work well today. So we have worked very hard to change that, and I think it has largely changed. There's still room for improvement, but the idea that we're going to suppress somebody's ideas or just tell them to shut up and get on the truck sort of a thing, those days are behind us, and I think for the better.
Yeah, I would agree, and certainly as we're going to talk when we come back from this break about your blog, the way to openly communicate with folks is a big difference. So we are going to pause for a moment, take a break here, get the news and updates at the bottom of the hour. By the way, if anyone's following, the Gators are ahead 10-3 over Tennessee. Still lots of time to talk to Wayne Hale at 321-768-1240. We're going to be back after a few minutes. More with Space Talk, sponsored by United Space Alliance, right here on WMMB.
Now, back to our own mission specialist, Jim Behnke.
Well, and here we go with the second half of Space Talk on this second week of the NFL season, in which I firmly predict my Minnesota Vikings will defeat the Detroit Lions. Like, that's going to be a tough game. 321-768-1240 is the number to call if you'd like to join in on our conversation with NASA's Wayne Hale. If you are a local AT&T wireless customer, you can punch in *1240 to join us. It's a free call. And our program today brought to you by United Space Alliance. And before we get back to Wayne, let's spend a moment to check in with Tracy Yates of United Space Alliance. Tracy, glad to welcome you to Space Talk.
Hi there, Jim.
How you doing? What's new at USA this week?
Well, as you mentioned, we're waiting for Discovery to return to KSC from Edwards Air Force Base out in California. And as you mentioned, we're hoping it occurs on Monday. We're also processing Atlantis and Endeavor for the next missions.
Uh-huh.
And meanwhile, at the same time, at KSC last Friday, on the same day Discovery landed, we had an important milestone in our launch preps for the Ares 1X test flight, which is coming up at the end of October. The rocket, which is now fully stacked in the vehicle assembly building, was successfully powered up for the very first time.
Wow.
Which was a big deal for those who've been working on it, and everything went really well.
So that's like you're moving into a brand new house and you're all excited and you flip the switch and the light comes on.
Yeah, and it's a very good feeling. And, you know, the ops desk that's located outside of High Bay 3, they had a little ceremony to plug in that vehicle-powered sign and it lit up, and folks are feeling pretty good about it.
So we've had Saturn V shuttle and now a brand new rocket. I mean, and you're getting two rockets ready to go at the same time.
Yeah, this is unprecedented for NASA to be processing two different human spaceflight vehicles in parallel, and it's been a huge challenge to choreograph the workforce, the facilities, the ground support equipment, and many other aspects between the two programs at the same time. I have to say, the schedulers and the integration team are the unsung heroes here.
That's great. Tracy, thanks for that update. We're going to check in with you pretty much on a weekly basis with our sponsor, United Space Alliance, and have you help us keep up to date on what's going on at Kennedy Space Center.
It'll be a pleasure.
Good. Thanks, Tracy.
Bye-bye.
Wayne Hale, what do you think about that, powering up the Ares 1X?
I think that's great and exciting. We're looking forward to the future, and I can't wait to see that rocket fly.
I can't wait. I can't wait to see it roll out, just to start with that. I was looking at the lightning towers the other day, the new lightning protection towers at Pad 39B, and they're so much taller. And to think that this rocket's going to roll out and be as tall as a Saturn V, I can't wait. I just can't wait. And Wayne, I guess the big question, and I don't know whether you have any insight into this or not, is, you know, do you think this rocket's going to fly?
Well, it remains to be seen. I certainly hope it does. People have worked very hard on it. I think they need to see the reward for all that hard work, and we can get a lot of information from that rocket because it's heavily instrumented, as a test flight ought to be.
Yeah, yeah.
There is, as you know, some discussion about what direction NASA ought to take in the future and whether the Ares 1 rocket has a role in that future is being currently discussed, you know, up at NASA headquarters and in the policy level decision-making.
Well, and let's get a little bit into that, because I know you're not directly associated with all that, but now, you know, Deputy Associate Administrator of Strategic Partnerships. What is that job all about, and how did you wind up getting there?
Well, as I tell everybody, it really means that whatever my boss needs me to do, I do. So that's the short answer. As we envisioned it about a year and a half ago when I stepped into the job, I would be working with other country space agencies, with other national agencies, with commercial interests and academia to develop partnerships and collaborations for the agency to carry out our mission of human and robotic exploration.
So this is not the job where you go cut a deal with Hollywood?
No, I don't get to talk to those kind of folks. That's
Google or those kind of partners.
No, this is more getting to talk to, you know, folks in the Air Force or potential international partners. I've had quite a bit of foreign travel in the last year, which, you know, when you're working on a shuttle program, you don't do a lot of foreign travel, typically. And so it's been very interesting.
Well, now, it's interesting, you know, to hear you describe your job, because at the same time that you've been doing this, you have really, I think, embraced this whole social online media. Certainly for our generation, it's harder and harder to do some of that, and you've nailed it. You know, you're on Facebook, and you're doing this blog, this incredible blog. Is that a part of your job, or is that just something you wanted to do on your own?
Well, part of my job is public outreach. That's very clearly one of my job elements. And I was asked early on to see if I couldn't try out some of this social media. I mean, here I am. I'm a grandfather. I'm 55, and a lot of the agency leadership is in my same demographic, shall we say.
Right.
And there is a huge interest in the world in the social media, and a lot of communication is moving that way. So they said, Wayne, try this out, see what you think. There were a few other people at NASA that had a blog, but they were pretty sad. They were like a press release
you
know, under somebody's name, and there was not a lot of human interest there. So I tried to do something a little different, talking about my days as a flight director, my work with the space shuttle program, or some other issues that were important to me. And everybody seems very pleased with the outreach. We get quite a few hits on the blog, and we have expanded, as you said, into Facebook, which is a whole other experience.
Yeah, really.
And Twitter.
Right.
Now, I'm not quite as avid a tweeter as some people are, but when I have something that I think people would be interested to know, I do put it out there.
Now, I have a question here that I got via AOL, as a matter of fact, via email, which is very appropriate, from Jerry from Rockledge. And then let me just read this to you, because I think it lays it all out. I'm amazed how Wayne Hale finds the time to generate an obviously well-thought-out blog 3 or 4 times a week in the midst of all his other NASA duties. What kinds of hours does he put in on a regular day, and how many hours of sleep does he get at night? Are there any, and that's, you know, okay, you're a hard worker, but the more interesting part of the question, are there any restrictions that NASA has for employee blogging that keep Wayne from saying things he would like to say? Are there things he would like to address that he hasn't felt comfortable writing about? And you've written about everything, Wayne. I don't know whether there is anything you're uncomfortable with.
Well, Jerry has a great question. You know, we are struggling as an agency as to what are the appropriate uses of social media by our folks. We have also looked at a bunch of other organizations. You know, if you talk about the NFL, you know, some of the teams on the NFL will find their players if they use Twitter.
Yeah, during a game, absolutely not.
Absolutely. Well, or about practices or
right.
any of that stuff. And the U.S. Army has restricted people from using a lot of the social media. Whereas if you go to some other places, you see very liberal policies. And part of NASA's mandate is to tell the public about what we're doing. It's written in the original Space Act back in 1958. And so we have this public outreach component. But we're trying to strike the happy medium. As far as my personal place in this, nobody has ever given me any instructions. It's really kind of funny. They said, go try it out. I said, are there any rules? They said, use your best judgment. And I frequently, after I write a blog, I will ask people in the public affairs office at headquarters or my management, was that okay? You know, should I have done something different? And I rarely get any feedback other than, that's great, keep doing what you're doing. Now, I do try to exercise some judgment. Obviously, there are some things that are probably best not talked about. I struggle very hard to tell a story in my blog, which came out of about a week and a half ago, about one of the early classified flights.
Right.
When this was before I had a security clearance, the flight was not completely classified. It just had some elements, and we did one thing that to this day, as far as I know, is still classified, and I talked about it in my blog. So far, the FBI hadn't shown up on my doorstep.
I read it very carefully, and it didn't say anything that I didn't already know.
Well, hopefully I got the point across, which really wasn't about security or secrecy.
No, not at all.
But did it in a way that didn't reveal anything that would harm our national security some 20 or 25 years after the fact.
I love the way you do interject some humor into this, too, and kind of a inside gotcha or tongue-in-cheek kind of, we all know the real story. But there was a couple quotes I pulled here from some of your recent blogs. Here's one of them where you're talking about you're actually reacting to the Augustine panel and whether we can ever be safe to fly in space. And you said, 6 years after the loss of Columbia, I'm not sure that we can make a spacecraft safe, but I have empirical evidence that proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that we can make it expensive. Well, boy, that's true, isn't it?
Well, it really is. You know, spaceflight is not safe. I'll tell that to anybody. And despite our best efforts, we still have escapes, and things happen, and, gosh, we never want to have another fatal accident, but I'd be kidding you if I told you it was guaranteed that we wouldn't. And part of the way that we do this is with this great bureaucratic process to try to kick over every rock, look in every hidden place, make sure that everything is done perfectly, and yet we know there are escapes. Sometimes I wonder if we don't overdo it and cause ourselves a huge amount of paperwork and bureaucracy that's not really contributing to safety. But it's very difficult to know when you cross the line between cutting back what is unnecessary to cross that invisible line that really hurts you in a safe way.
Well, and you ended that blog with a quote from James Cameron at a safety conference that you had attended. And he said, and this was a great way to end your blog, while safety is very important and must be considered at all times, in exploration, safety is not actually the most important thing. In exploration, the most important thing is to go.
I think that's a great quote. I wish I had said it. I have. That sums up, I think, what our philosophy ought to be.
Absolutely. And the opposite of expensive does not mean cheaper, or you can't make it cheaper and still be safe. There's no doubt about it. Wayne, hang on for a minute. We're going to do a two-minute break here, come back with some more thoughts and comments from Wayne Hale. This is Space Talk on WMMB. I'm Jim Banky.
It's an Endeavor World program.
Roger, roll, Endeavor.
Now is the time for shuttle program employees to chart a new course. A course that will take their careers beyond the last space shuttle mission to new job opportunities and horizons.
Fine, let's go.
Brevard Workforce is helping our community shuttle engineers, technicians, and administrative workers to launch new careers through the Aerospace Workforce Transition Program.
Houston, flight is go.
While they continue to safely launch the remaining shuttle missions. Through the programs, resources, and services, aerospace workers can map out a strategy, undergo skill assessments, take workshops, update degrees and certifications, or receive education funding. Assistance is available and ready.
PTC, go.
Contact Brevard Workforce today and take the first easy step to prepare for a successful post-shuttle career in aerospace or other industries.
The launch team is ready to proceed.
Call Brevard Workforce at 394-0556. That's 394-0556. Visit them online at launchnewcareers.com or Twitter them at launchcareers.
You are go for launch.
If it's happening in space, Jim Banky is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
And we're back with the final segment, Space Talk on WMMB, sponsored by United Space Alliance. NASA's Wayne Hale is with us today, calling from Houston. And Wayne, let's talk about one more blog entry before I start wrapping this up. And I told you we were going to talk about this one. I am a lifelong Star Trek fan, a big deal fan, and he, Wayne, you wrote a blog a few weeks ago about Star Trek ruining a generation of space explorers. And while, you know, the whole thing was very fair and balanced, you know, you said some things I looked at, and it was almost like you were a big Houston, Texas fan saying that the Vikings were the worst team in football. And if you'd written that, I would have been even more upset. So here's one thing what you said. You know, you talked about how Star Trek makes everything in space look so easy. So you said, so a whole generation, or maybe three, has been ruined to expect excitement, glamour, interspecies interaction, and a host of things that space exploration in the real universe simply does not provide. Ruined. Expectations set too high. Thus, we have many people who might otherwise support space exploration, but are disappointed by its current status. And, you know, while that makes sense to me, on the other hand, so many people have been inspired by the show and science fiction in general that it was a thought that hadn't really occurred to me. I guess you see people out there thinking that we have warp drive already.
Well, first of all, I have to say I was inspired by Star Trek. I have every one of the original episodes memorized verbatim.
Good for you.
And we can do that, quote, line by line sometime if you'd like.
Next show.
But the real problem is that folks believe that what you see in these fictional television movies, and not just Star Trek, but the whole science fiction genre,
yeah,
is something that we ought to be able to do. And we simply don't know how to do much of that stuff. And in 200 or 300 or 400 years, yeah, we'll be doing it. Great. But right now, I am continually surprised that people think that we ought to be able to do those things, and are very disappointed when you tell them, no, we really don't know how to do it right now.
And they think the shuttle flies to the moon, and we've landed on Venus, you know, with people and all the other things.
You know, there are some comedians that have made a living going out and interviewing people in the street on common things and finding out how ignorant some folks can be.
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, Wayne, I want to wrap this up, and I want to spend in the last few minutes that we have together actually reading one of your blogs, because this one was really neat, and I think it's so important, and it shows what you're doing and what you're talking about and a little insight into your... So if you'll bear with me, I'm going to read this. It's only going to take a couple of minutes. But this one was the one entitled Carrying the Torch, and it was written to the space workforce. So this is Wayne Hale saying, I've said before that the exploration of space reminds me of the Olympic torch relay. So here is a note to all of you relay runners who carry the torch every day in your work, to those who have retired from the race, and to those who dream of carrying the fire one day. Not everybody gets to carry the torch up the stadium steps and light the cauldron in the presence of tens of thousands and the virtual presence of tens of millions. Only a very few get to carry the torch in moments of glory. Not everyone who carries the torch is remembered. Only a few names are ever announced. Not everybody gets to carry the torch over the mountaintops. Just a handful get to carry the fire through magnificent vistas. Not everybody gets to carry the torch where it is cheered on by adoring crowds. Somebody has to carry the torch in the rain. Somebody has to carry the torch through the valley. Somebody has to carry the torch through the warehouse district in the swamp. Somebody even has to carry the torch in places where the onlookers jeer. But the torch has to be carried. If the flame is ever to reach its goal, if the cheering multitudes are ever to see the final runner holding the torch high, it must be carried. Space exploration is like that. Some days are glorious days, some days are awful, and most days can be tedious. But if we stumble and the torch falls and the light goes out, then all the dreams and all the sweat of all those who came before us will be for naught, and all the hopes for those who might have carried the torch after us will fade away in the night. We don't get to choose the section of the course we run, we just get to carry the torch. Celebrate with those who carry the torch in glory days. Know that glory days will come again. Don't forget to hold it high, even in ordinary times, even in the presence of those who jeer, because those who carry the torch carry the future in their hands. Because even if you have to run through the desert and never hear the cheering throngs, you are still carrying the fire. And how well you run your distance is the only reward that is truly worth having. Incredible words, Wayne, and you are truly a steely-eyed missile man. You have the brain of a rocket scientist, and what's so cool is the heart of a poet. And I don't know how you come up with this stuff, but this is good stuff. And this is stuff that this space workforce and everybody needs to hear. And thank you for doing it.
I'm inspired by the people I work alongside every day. They keep me going, Jim.
Well, thank you for running that distance and carrying the torch for all of us. We're going to say goodbye to you, Wayne, as we wrap up the program. Thanks for being on the show. We'll have you back on again, and we'll talk more Star Trek.
I'll look forward to it.
Okay, Wayne. Take care.
Bye-bye.
There goes Wayne Hale, NASA flight director and just all-around great guy. So we appreciate that very much. Well, look, let's in a couple of minutes here, I want to let you know that there's kind of some big news about Space Talk here. Next week, Space Talk is going to move to a permanent new time of 2 o'clock in the afternoon. A lot of this has to do with UCF college football, but ultimately when that gets all over with, we're going to be on at 2 o'clock on Saturdays immediately following the Kim Komando program. So if you're a regular listener to Kim, just keep it tuned right to WMMB, and we'll be right on the air right there following her. In the meantime, there are going to be some weeks coming up here now where we are going to be preempted by UCF football. And we'll certainly announce those weeks when it's going to happen. We don't have one coming up for, I think, 2 more weeks now. But in any case, when it does, what we're going to do is we're going to stream the program live on WMMBAM.com. So you'll be able to hear the program just like normal at 2 o'clock on Saturday by listening to it online at your computer. Or if you can't do it then we'll again have the program available as a podcast, generally speaking, the Monday after the weekend. And so we won't miss a beat here. We won't skip a beat. We'll continue bringing you the latest space news and guests from the space program. And so we'll be all set to go in that way. So again, beginning next week, Space Talk will be on the air Saturdays at 2 p.m. on WMMB following the Kim Komando show. We're still working on guests for this particular week, but we've got Frank DiBello coming up in the weeks ahead. We're going to be hearing from some folks in the military, some other folks from around the community as well. So we've got a lot to talk about in the fall coming up, and we want you right here with us on WMMB. Thanks for being with us today. This is Space Talk on WMMB, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Thanks to our guest, Wayne Hale. Thanks to you for listening in. We'll talk to you again real soon. Again, I'm Jim Bankey, and you're listening to WMMB.